Yeah, for those of you who are looking forward to a poetry film, I'm not it.
Sorry, we're not having a poetry film tonight.
Yeah. Okay, so this poem is about, that must be a year and a half. This is currently titled Third Poem, because it's my third effort at writing something with R.E.M. song titles. There's a whole load of lines through bits of it here. So I decided I'm just going to read it and see what stays and maybe lose some of it. Here I am again, stuck on you, my magnetic north dancing barefoot around the yellow and orange summertime sun that does not touch my wretched heart. How I wish gravity would stumble, that its undertow could disappear so you could fall on me, warm my soul or raise me from this low I sometimes believe is everlasting. Yet these days the strange currencies of silence you bring beat out of time, and their hollow message, now that you're gone at my most beautiful, I am psychologically overcast, is reduced, diminished, and I fret less. I'm not afraid when I remember California on the last day of our acquaintance, when I took your name time after time beneath the near wild heaven carnival of southern stars, and after hours walking in the street, saw your pale blue eyes in the orange crush of the great beyond. I'm not afraid when I remember our last date, you leaving me leaving New York, with night swimming in clouds over the river and endless possibilities lingering on the perfect bittersweet memory of you, me, a future. Listen to me, you murmur. There is no retrospective remedy to this imitation of life, and there is no perfect memory. Stained by the passage of time, perception and emotion, memory morphs, is always imperfect. But every day is yours to win, so write the phases of your reconstruction. Be alive and living now, because all the lessons of life's rich pageant are clear and simple if you live for today. So why not smile? Say goodbye. Let me go. For a while, I believe this is the worst joke ever, that the end of the world has discovered my Neverland. But then, once again, I say your name time after time, and as I do, I wish for release to get out of this place, to say here I am again to Funtime. Suddenly a dark globe descends and my heart accelerates as the ghost of you leaves through a fascinating fireplace. And as I watch your red head walking away and disappear, I feel uneasy and know that the high-speed bang and blame train is a dead medium, that the pills prophecy your photograph too often jams in my mind's eye is on a permanent vacation, and that a chromosome of hope is opening a credit line on a document named Life and How to Live It. And then I'm shaking all over while laughing, I don't want you anymore. And though my suspicious instinct still says I'm not over you, I know I will survive and walk unafraid into freedom's flame to love somebody else.
Next we have Jack Shortland.
I wrote this for those that I work with young people with intellectual disability. But as it wrote itself, I found tapping into my own specific, undiagnosed, really learning difficulties. It's called Transcendence. Her hands were a pair of fire tongs, too loose for the lump of coal. One of her feet tripped up in the skipping and was always 7 months old. Her elbow was some kind of racket. Doing her writing made her blink. Her blink was a clock face made of a slate, chalked out with the shillings and ounces and the sums she couldn't do, and her brain was the enormous turnip. But from under her own blanket, her toes became Tinkerbells all in a row, and her fingers moved with the swifts, and all about her were seashell whispers, and inside she felt the crackle of Rice Krispies. And her heart was a soft, red purse, and in this she kept all her lullabies.
Very nicely done.
rid of the brain drain, this is called the drain brain. They tell us we have three brains, one in the head, one in the heart, the other is in the gut. When all three are in sync, everything is fine. Trouble starts when head and heart fall out of line. Most of us forget about the gut. I did, to my cost. At one stage, I seemed to have a fourth brain, a cyst that in the past erupted on my shoulder, they called it a lymphoma, had lodged inside for more than 30 years. I found it had a mind of its own. Each time I struggled into something sleek, I noticed that the effort made me groan. Though not painful, it grew bigger. The expert said, best to cut it out. My heart sank, my head said no. In the past, when my body was subjected to procedures, my digestion stalled, went into lockdown. Food, instead of transforming itself into a more familiar four-letter word, was all too soon regurgitated. To avoid the pitfalls of a general anesthetic, I asked for a local one instead, where I would not be too sedated. The surgeon cut into the ugly lump, talking to me as I lay awake, hunched on my side, aware of nips and piercings, but nothing too intrusive. The gangly mess of tissue he extracted was as big as a small rugby ball. To me, it had the features of a brain. After 80 minutes on the table, I lay in the daybed to recover. At home that night, I had a hearty meal, thrilled to have come through a chastening ordeal. I wish that I could tell you all went well, but my gut rejected the painkillers prescribed. Its resisting brain played a game of pitch and toss. For the next 11 days, it showed me who was boss.
I wrote this just earlier on today in Peace Park. Some people might know it as Bishop Lucy Park. If I'm bad at reading it, that's why. Peace Park. Water plummets the swan-encircled fountain ahead, batting at each level like a bunch of energetic schoolboys, mindlessly making noise. The pitter-patter of a puppy playing, unknowingly learning, to my left, effortlessly lifts the mood. Meanwhile, a crow of equal size takes up post on the head of a little old lady made of metal, and the man with no name bums a rolly off some middle-aged can suppers. This place is alive. A steady overcast hovers above, and yet the sun seeps seamlessly through the cotton bud clouds. There's laughter. The puppy's parents are proud. The joyous simplicity of it all kisses me. I'm temporarily engulfed by the crowd, and I catch myself looking around as if all along I'd been thinking aloud.
Meeting a friend that I hadn't seen for quite some time. It's called Ships in the Night. Like ships in the night, we said, hello, my oldest friend and I. How are things? Where have you been? What's life been like for you? We spent the time catching up. We laughed about olden days. We remembered loves lost and won. We hugged in an old embrace. Like ships in the night, we said goodbye, my oldest friend and I. See you again. We will meet again soon. Let's not leave it too long this time. Loves lost were true, and we both knew love in times gone by. Like ships in the night, we sailed away, my oldest friend and I.
And now we have Joel.
Thanks. Thank you. Mysteries. I met Professor Bryden, a scientist at Yale, on the night train to Denver. We just scratched the surface, he said. What we see is only 4% of what is there. The professor ran his fingers repeatedly through strands of thinning hair, trailing them recklessly over wide patches of open landscape. Only 4% of matter is visible. The remaining 96% is dark matter. We know nothing about it. The train pulled out with a screech. The Big Bang, the professor said, black holes, quarks, the human genome, the God particle. Since the dawn of time, nobody even dreamed of such things. The professor tapped his fingers in time with the engine as it choked on into the darkness. He spoke of hyperspace, multi-dimensions, parallel universes, an ancient cluster, planetary nebulae. In time, he said, once we've broken the speed of light, we may find life in outer space. Our descendants may look back from some space colony and think that time never existed at all, and that Earth was just a myth. The professor nodded his head in vigorous agreement with himself. That would certainly explain a lot. He removed his glasses and began rubbing the lenses. Everything is relative, you see. Mankind is still in its infancy. He gestured impulsively as he spoke, and his glasses flapped all over the place like a bird trying to get free but unable to, because the professor was holding one of its wings. The strangest things happen. Objects fall from clear skies. Fish, hazelnuts, frogs. He opened his eyes wide as if trying to suck me into his brain. A month ago in Philadelphia, a massive block of ice crashed to a slate roof, killing a woman as she sat watching Judge Judy. What do you think of that? I shook my head, unable to find adequate words. And just last week, a man in Oregon spontaneously combusted, burnt to a cinder. Crazy things happen. He fumbled his spectacles back on, curling the arms around each ear. Of course, a lot goes right, too. There may even be a god, after all. He laughed, then frowned uncomfortably, as if that idea disconcerted him, as if God might turn out to be the cat among the pigeons. A little later, just as the train was entering a tunnel, I asked Bryden what was bringing him to Denver. The lights in the carriage flickered on and off, and the professor was suddenly like a character on an old black and white film reel. A moment later, the train thundered free again, and we hurled on through the dark, sleeping heart of America. I'm visiting my mother, the professor said. I see, I said, nodding, trying to give the impression that that explained everything, and he needn't feel any obligation to say more. My mother is 92, he went on. She remarried in her 70s for the third time, and has been living ever since with her latest husband on a farm just outside Denver. Gosh, I said. I want to consult her on a personal matter, he said, in a husky voice, then fell silent, leaving me wondering. It wasn't until just before dawn, when our train was pulling through a misty rain into Denver Station, that the professor made his revelation. What he wanted to discuss with his elderly mother, apparently, was an even darker mystery than black holes, dark matter, or any other scientific conundrum. The professor was hoping his thrice married mother could help him to figure out why his wife had left him.
Contender. Dancing through the most meagre weddings, sleepy talking in the library, busy as ever, setting on a pattern that serves to annoy. Behold, dear patron, the day is still young. Freshened air blaring from the ceilingscape, a welcome open window clamorous to time. Weak at times while breaking mental codes. Making up templates a choice of occupation. The audience is always right, individually of course, winning the jigsaw puzzle a good feat. Not even sardonic praise opens doors, proper channels adhere to biting off heads. Appreciate the slow burn of essential procedure. Time is being of the essence, unnerving for all. Life through a keyboard hits accurately. Slightest mistakes burn to prospects. Erring in caution, favours go unpunished. Standard protocol is not all bad. Shooting of stairs, at first hard experience. Shake from hunger, a pain for your art. Assign certain niches, strongly attended. Dark for a while, taken for leave, forsaken. A comedy of episodes where shown as intended, cleaning up nicely, redeeming procedure. Thank you.
Well done, Patricia. Charles. The Invisible Charles Clark.
Thank you.
There we go. Is that okay,
Charles? Right. I think today, maybe, is the first day of the Galway races. It is also the day on which England have beaten South Africa in cricket. And hence,
South Africa fan.
Right. Of these three very short poems is a poem by Harold Pinter, who was passionately keen on cricket, the great playwright, etc. I saw Lynn Hutton in his prime, another time. So he sent this around to friends, including Simon Gray, playwright. And I'm old enough to remember seeing all these people in London, all their efforts, all their plays, etc. And Simon Gray didn't respond, and he wondered why. So the answer was, he asked him why. What did you think of it? And he said, I haven't finished it yet. Second poem is from the old Irish. The Song of the King of Moy, son of the King of Moy, in midsummer found a girl in the greenwood. She gave him black fruit from thorn bushes. She gave him an armful of strawberries on rushes. This is translated by Miles Dillon from a poem of about 7 or 8 century AD. And then, for my own little offerings, Buddha, UCC. Over that November weekend, the Buddha prince became reliquary, reigned over the Aulang Max.
Arguing the whole time about cricket, but I'm not sure if it's funny mean, but I used to work for the UCC curator, and I remember a Buddha statue in a warehouse somewhere, so maybe that's it, I don't know. So now we have a man of many talents, Aaron Lewis.
I was at a festival in West Cork, and the storyteller didn't like the microphone, neither do I. So,
what? Can't hear you, sorry. what? What?
So this is a poem I came across in Galway in 2006 in a house. It's originally from an American TV show called Northern Exposure. I don't know if anybody's heard of it.
Yeah.
I met a German girl at a storytelling night in Galway, May 2006. We bumped into each other the next day and went for tea. We were randomly chatting up for 3 hours about life, spirituality, following your heart and being yourself. Nearing the end of our conversation, she held my hand in both of her hands and said, "Aaron, I want you to do something for me." I inquired, perplexed, what she wanted me to do. "I want you to go to this house, ring on the doorbell and ask to read the quotation written on the stairs." She gave me directions to the house, and as I was leaving, we warmly embraced and she said, "Keep living." I went on my random little quest on a wet afternoon in Galway and proceeded to the address given to me by my new friend. I arrived at the house and pushed the black doorbell, which rang with a trill. A beautiful Polish girl with brown eyes and tight curly bobbed hair answered the door. "I'm here to read the quote written on the stairs," as if this was a regular occurrence. She welcomed me in and pointed me to the stairs and went back to whatever she was doing before I trilled the doorbell. The house had a musty smell of damp or maybe stale ganja. A dark old coat rack with trilbies, floral scarves and tie-dyed coats on it. There was lots of juggling equipment on the floor and different coloured clubs and juggling equipment. The words painted on the light blue stairs and black calligraphy-like writing was the quote. "It's the coming back, the return, which gives meaning to the going forth. We don't always know where we've been until we get back to where we were. Only where we were may not be as it was because of who we have become, which is, after all, why we left."
Martin Purcell. Sorry, did I read?
Yes, you did.
I'm sorry for you.
For being last?
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Well,
shall I just stop you?
Yes, okay. It's fine for me.
Okay.
It's the great trepidation that I put this together. And hopefully, this is the first page of my book, because I want to be like Mary O'Malley and write many books. But I'm sure it will get better than this as time goes on. Hopefully, I have to get your attention for a little while now and keep you entertained, because my glasses are my third eye, which I cannot see without, even though it's big print. It's an attempt at some kind of a sonnet. I'm not sure if you'll recognize it as so. But the theme is a time of urgent natural need. "Your rhymes says she, your what says he, as they marched along the road. Where will we find it, says she? Oh God, I don't know, says he. In the distance it looked like a shade, then knew it was not made, then saw it was a covering bush. Both grappled to get there in a great rush. Their sighs of relief were loud and expressive. People passing might have thought it depressive. Then saw them emerge with utter relief. It surely was beyond their social belief. They fixed themselves up and tidied away, then sidled along for the rest of the day.
I know Martin's a big fan of Mary and that's why he came tonight, but I hope you come back and meet us again next week.
Thank you.
Benjamin Burns, everybody.
I've been reading Aurora Leigh by Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and I think it's deadly, so I'm going to read you a couple of pages. The critics say that epics have died out with Agamemnon and the goat-nursed gods. I'll not believe it. I could never deem, as Payne Knight did, the mythic mountaineer who travelled higher than he was born to live and showed sometimes the goiter in his throat discoursing of an image seen through fog, that Homer's heroes measured 12 feet high. They were but men. His Helen's hair turned grey, like any plain Miss Smith's who wears a front, and Hector's infant whimpered at a plume, as yours last Friday at a turkey cock. All actual heroes are essential men, and all men possible heroes. Every age, heroic in proportions, double-faced, looks backwards and before, expects a morn and claims an epos. Aye, but every age appears to souls who live in it, asked Carlyle, most unheroic. Ours, for instance, ours. The thinkers scout it and the poets abound, who scorn to touch it with a fingertip. A pewter age, mixed metal, silver washed, an age of scum, spooned off the richer past. An age of patches for old gabardines, an age of mere transition, meaning nought, except that what succeeds must shame it quite, if God please. That's wrong thinking, to my mind, and wrong thoughts make poor poems. Every age, through being beheld too close, is ill discerned by those who have not lived past it. We'll suppose Mount Athos carved, as Alexander schemed, to some colossal statue of a man. The peasants, gathering brushwood in his ear, had guessed as little as the browsing goats of form or feature of humanity up there. In fact, had travelled 5 miles off, or ere the giant image broke on them, full human profile, nose and chin distinct, mouth muttering rhythms of silence up the sky, and fed at evening with the blood of suns, grand torso, hand that flung perpetually the largesse of a silver river down to all the country pastures. 'Tis even thus with times we live in, evermore too great to be apprehended near. But poets should exert a double vision, should have eyes to see near things as comprehensively as if afar they took their point of sight, and distant things as intimately deep as if they touched them. Let us strive for this. I do distrust the poet who discerns no character or glory in his times, and trundles back his soul 500 years past moat and drawbridge into a castle court to sing, oh, not of lizard or of toad alive in the ditch there, 'twere excusable, but of some black chief, half knight, half sheep-lifter, some beauteous dame, half châtel and half queen, as dead as must be for the greater part, the poems made on their chivalric bones, and that's no wonder, death inherits death. Nay, if there's room for poets in this world a little overgrown, I think there is. Their sole work is to represent the age, their age, not Charlemagne's, this live, throbbing age that brawls, cheats, maddens, calculates, aspires, and spends more passion, more heroic heat betwixt the mirrors of its drawing rooms than Roland with his knights at Roncesvalles, to flinch from modern varnish, coat or flounce, cry out for togas and the picturesque is fatal, foolish too. King Arthur's self was commonplace to Lady Guinevere, and Camelot to minstrels seemed as flat as Fleet Street to our poets. Never flinch, but still unscrupulously epic, catch upon the burning lava of a song the full-veined, heaving, double-breasted age that, when the next shall come, the men of that may touch the impress with reverent hand and say, behold,
Behold, upon the paps we all have supped, this bosom seems to beat still, or at least it sets ours beating. This is living art, which thus presents and thus records through life.
Great choice of reading, then. So now we have Ali.
This is very short. Stop. Stop giving out about the internet. We all said the same things about the printing press.
Great. And I think before the next couple of readers, maybe the excellent Pat Copper will give us
a seasonal poem. It's not in season, but it's seasonal.
Halloween. Black is to them as beige is to others. From the house of the raging Satanists, the little girl dresses as a nun at Halloween. Full regalia, heavy wooden cross on globular beaded chain, severe distressed medieval wimple, like something handed down the generations from Torquemada. Swishing black habit, heavy and simple as sin, she walks her street, eyes turned often to the heavens, as if witnessing a hovering, stalking angel, luminescent with virtue, just over her head. She petrifies the neighborhood children by blessing them and acclaiming Et Spiritus Sancti. Some would say she is saving her own soul without knowing.
Now our five-word challenge winner, Kieran McCartan.
You know how it works.
Thanks, lad.
If you're around on Thursday, lads, fifth floor playing the flurry, many old bale heads comprise the fifth floor. Great band, and me and me have a good open for them. I said some poems and do some tunes. Etc. So it's 9 o'clock in the Friary on Thursday, if you're around. I'm going to give you a brief history of this document. In relation to another story, my goddaughter was christened last weekend, and it was a grand old time of it now. Was thinking about what it is to be a godfather to a baby, and not wanting to inflict a life sentence on the child. I said it, my vows would be of a non-religious nature, and more of a kind of a
admit you're a Taoist.
Perhaps. But this document wasn't written by me. I don't actually know where this comes from. I found this in my office one day. And so if you recognize these words and know who the author is, you can thank them for me. And kill the belief that it was sent to me from a stare.
Like a fortune cookie.
And it also has glitter on the back, which I think they were just doing to fuck with me because I have a phobia of glitter. These are some words anyway. There is a vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all of time, this expression is unique. and if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium, and it will be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours, clearly and directly, to keep the channel open.
You're going to make a great godfather, Tyrone. At least you'll inspire him poetically, if nothing else. So now, last but not least, Rob Urquhart.
This is my poster. If you're free on Thursday, well, hang on a minute. If you're free on Thursday, come along to the Friary. You can tell what it is by the picture of it. It's at the bottom of Shandon Street. And the lads will be playing. Kieran will be there, Ben will be there, and a few other big boys as well.
So how much is it to get in?
It's free.
Oh, it's free.
It's free for you, Pat, anyway.
It's free for everybody here now.
It's 10 for you, Stan.
Yeah. Why am I not surprised?
A Protestant poem. My anger and frustration lead to my self-devaluation, to degradation, lethargy and sloth. By sitting, smoking, thinking, procrastinating and drinking, I get to the place where I don't give a toss. And the only thing I've found to consistently make my world go round is work, practice, effort. Call it what you will, and sometimes it's a bitter pill, but still, work, practice, effort leads to true relaxation instead of sitting around biting off my fingernails in agitation. Work, practice, effort.